This episode is brought to you by Windrose Recovery, a family of premier addiction treatment programs in southeastern Wisconsin. Privately owned, Windrose Recovery offers a full continuum of personalized care for those struggling with addiction, including the Manor for residential treatment, Midwest Detox for inpatient detoxification, and Windrose Counseling for outpatient treatment. With highly personalized treatment focused on trauma, Dr. Chantel Thomas and her expert team offer an authentic experience, creating the kind of deep emotional change that's crucial for long-term recovery. If you or someone you love is struggling with addiction, call Windrose Recovery at 414-409-5300. You can learn more about Windrose Recovery by clicking the link in the show notes or by visiting WindroseRecovery.com. Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of the show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are. Live on the road.
Hi, I'm Heather Stewart, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
Nowhere to run, nothing to hide from the government's prying eye. Take yourself a summer holiday.
The Path to Authenticity proudly supports the I Speak Media Foundation, advancing media literacy education through an evolving series of outreach programs within the communities that need it most. For more information, visit ispeakmedia.org. If this is your first time here, thanks for checking it out. If not, thanks for coming back. I'm Tom Gentry. This is The Path to Authenticity, episode 103 for January 5th, 2021. On this date, Bradley Cooper was born, the Italian novelist Umberto Eco was born, as well as Walter Mondale. And on this day in 1914, Henry Ford shocked the world when he announced that he would pay a minimum wage of $5 per day and that he would share with his employees $10 million of profit from 1913, the previous year. So this episode features a philosopher and PhD candidate named Heather Stewart, who is at the University of Western Ontario. And as much as I bemoan social media these days, especially Facebook, I met Heather on an online group, on a Facebook group. And I talk about that a little bit in the episode. But Heather focuses on feminist philosophy as well as medical ethics. We talk about both of those things. We touch on microaggressions, misogyny, double standards in our culture, politics. And if you think liberal is bad, you're probably not going to like this episode. Recorded it on December 15th. And here we are a couple weeks later, ready to go. It's going to be a good episode. I hope you enjoy it. Heather Stewart.
No. prying eye.
Take yourself to it's been holiday. Unseasonably warm for mid-December, you know, mid-80s today. So it's been really nice weather, and you are in London, Ontario?
That's right. Yeah, I'm in London, Ontario. It's actually been fairly warm for Ontario in December here as well. So it's been nice to get out and get some walks.
So what does warm in December in London, Ontario look like?
I was going to say, I normally would answer that in Celsius, but in Fahrenheit here, it's 25 right now.
Okay.
But there's no snow on the ground right now. So that's what I take warm in London, Ontario in December to be.
Yeah.
Snow on the horizon in the coming days, though. So.
So you are a PhD candidate in philosophy at the University of Western Ontario?
Yeah, that's right. I am in the home stretch. We'll be wrapping things up around hopefully June or so.
So then you're doing a lot of teaching right now?
Yeah, that's right. Right now I'm teaching for two schools in the States. So for the University of Louisville in Kentucky and for the University of Colorado in Boulder, Colorado.
So that's all Zoom stuff, I take it.
Yeah, it's been quite different and quite the adjustment, because one thing I love about teaching is, you know, the face-to-face interaction with your students and sort of being able to see when things are clicking for them. So trying to modify all of that to Zoom has been different, but I think it's been going okay.
Good. Well, so what do you teach more specifically? What's your specialty?
Yeah, my specialty is within the area of bioethics and feminist philosophy largely. Right now I'm teaching a course on sex and values. So students think a lot about different relationship forms, right? Queer relationships and polyamorous relationships and the institution of marriage, and right, they kind of question their assumptions about those things. I'm doing a class on introduction to medical ethics, and that's been fun because we've talked a lot about pandemic ethics and the allocation of scarce health resources and things like that. And I'm also teaching a course on social and political philosophy. So those are generally the areas that I research and teach in.
You're busy.
I'm very busy. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, you being in Canada and me being in the U.S. when it comes to bioethics, and someone who's spent my career in behavioral healthcare, and there's nothing no bigger headache in my world than dealing with insurance. And I've been able to avoid it mostly because the clientele I've worked with, it's cash pay. And in my industry, it's like there's the haves and the have nots. The have nots who are completely insurance dependent, and they don't get services as quickly. They don't get them as easily. I mean, everything is more difficult. And then, you know, the haves, they get the best of everything because, you know, those facilities that, you know, can cater to that clientele can afford to do the best work and have adequate staff and all that kind of stuff. And it just kind of drives me crazy because why should we profit from someone's well-being? You know, that doesn't seem right to me.
Yeah, that's totally right. And even in the medical ethics course I'm teaching now, I have a lot of students who are either pre-med or nursing students, and they tend to want to go into healthcare professions. And so I do a unit on the question of whether healthcare is a human right and sort of moral arguments for Medicare for all, and just try to get them to think about what you just said, right? Like how the system of healthcare in the U.S. reproduces injustices and inequalities in health and well-being, and to try to get them to think about whether they think there's a better way of doing things. And it's just so different than teaching here in Canada, right, where there is a single-payer system and people generally can assume that they're going to get at least a decent quality of healthcare, sort of regardless of their class or race or gender. And of course, there are still, you know, discrepancies there, but much different than in the U.S. for sure.
Yeah. Well, and then the insurance industry, that part of it, I mean, I talk to families a lot who are trying to obtain services. And one of the things I hear coming out of my mouth a lot to remind them of is that, you know, insurance providers are in the business of making a profit. Mm-hmm. They're not there to help you. Not really. And, you know, going through the channels to get services paid for by an insurance mm-hmm. provider, it seems so apparent that it's so complicated that it's just designed to get the consumer to give up and to stop asking for it, you know?
Yeah, it's just so convoluted that, you know, you almost need to be an expert in sort of healthcare policy or have a lot of time on your hands, right? To constantly be sort of making calls and challenging where claims have been denied and stuff. And it's really, really results in, like you said, a lot of people just deciding to give up. And, you know, then people incur a bunch of medical debt pertaining to medical expenses. And
or they don't get treated.
Or they don't get treated at all. Exactly. Yeah. And the fact that in the U.S. you have people, right, deciding whether or not to take their child in for, you know, medical treatment that they think they need, but they're afraid of the bills that are going to come with that.
Right.
That's, yeah, pretty devastating.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, well, it's unethical, isn't it?
Yeah.
I believe it is.
Yeah, for sure. And like, these are the sorts of questions in philosophy that I'm really interested in, right? Are the ones that like questions that really directly bear on people's actual lives. And, you know, I sort of joke when I talk to people because the stereotype of philosophy is that it's, you know, very abstract and, you know, these questions that have very little to do with how we live our day-to-day lives. But I think, you know, these are the sorts of issues in philosophy that I'm really interested in. Like, how do we design healthcare systems that allow people to actually get quality healthcare and not put themselves in debt trying to get it and so on. So these are the sorts of things that I really care about.
Mm. So then where does the feminist philosophy come in?
Yeah. So I think my approach to sort of all the questions that I deal with in philosophy is from a feminist perspective. And I mean that pretty broadly. I mean that when I say I do feminist philosophy, I'm interested in gender justice broadly. I'm interested in anti-racist work. I'm interested in LGBTQ plus inclusion. So feminist analysis helps me kind of look at differences in power, even the sorts of things that you just highlighted, the haves and the haves and not have nots, right? So I'm interested in how our institutions are laid out to disproportionately benefit some people and harm some people, and how we might think about, you know, designing things more equitably and more justly. And so that feminist lens sort of comes in at every level that I do work.
One of the things that is sort of frustrating to me when it comes to these matters is that, well, and until you're kind of tuned into it, you just don't see it.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the examples of misogyny that I use a lot that I think most men and a lot of women, at mm-hmm. least in my world and in the United States, are kind of numb to it. You know, so you're in a corporate work environment and most of the department heads are male. And then there's a woman, like I worked at a great agency and we had a couple different female department heads who were in good leadership roles and they were great at their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Like really sharp. Like truth be told, in terms of effectiveness, probably ran circles around their peers who were the heads of the other mm-hmm. departments. But and I, you know, I have five sisters. I grew up around a bunch of women, you know. So I've mm-hmm. always been comfortable around women. And I both of these women I worked for at different times and had really good work relationships with and a lot of respect for them, got close to them. And then I would be around my peers in other departments who would just she's a bitch, you know, like that kind of stuff. And I knew them personally, and I knew that that wasn't true. But the fact that they had a voice and they used it, and they didn't just take no for an answer, the fact that they basically, the fact that they acted as an equal to the men in the equal roles made them just automatically be labeled a bitch.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you see that, right? Like in politics, right? So if you think about somebody like Hillary Clinton or, but really, you know, any sort of woman in politics, you get this sort of double bind where if they're not outspoken, they're deemed too sort of weak or meek to be in the role. But if they are, you know, speaking out and being strong, then they're deemed as, you know, too aggressive or, like you said, a bitch. And that's what the double bind of, like, you know, you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't kind of thing. And I think at the end of the day, like a lot of men end up really like in these positions of power, whether it's politics or, you know, in my case, in the academy, men are really threatened by women sort of moving into positions of power. And I mean, maybe, I don't know if you saw this or not, but there's the thing circulating right now where this person wrote an article calling on Dr. Biden not to refer to doctor, right?
I saw that,
and I think like that's such a textbook example of what you're talking about. Like downplaying her credentials and her hard work and the fact that she's earned a doctorate. And then this person who doesn't have a doctorate, mind you, is or an advanced degree at all, is like calling on her not to, you know, use the title that she's earned. And I just think there's really like men, you know, not all men, of course, but there's this sort of sense of feeling threatened by women in leadership roles and in positions of power. And it's just one sort of insidious way that misogyny kind of creeps in.
Well, and to me, in American politics, the glaring examples are Nancy Pelosi and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Absolutely.
There's the bitch category, and then there's the crazy category.
Yeah.
You know, so either she's crazy or she's a bitch or she's both. And I think they kind of have AOC in the both category. But, you know, I mean, what I see when I look at her is someone who's fighting for us.
Absolutely. And who has had to actually like work to get where she is.
Right.
Like this working class background and this, you know, she has worked in, you know, the food service industry, like doing sort of backbreaking work, working as a bartender late hours. And like, she just has this story that's so unfamiliar to people in Washington, D.C. that they feel threatened by it. Right. Mm. It's not the sort of normal private school to, you know, Ivy League pedigree kind of story that a lot of Washington D.C.
It is actually what we call the American dream. I mean, that's what it is. She's the embodiment of it. Yet you have all these people who, you know, there's all this vitriol towards her. And what baffles me even more about it is how they have the working class people, you know, singing the same tune.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so upsetting to me. But yeah, I mean, I think you're right, right? Like if you look at AOC, that's a perfect case of somebody that did what we think you should be able to do in America. But people still, you know, I don't know if you remember this case, but there was a case when the Republicans were really just trying to wear her down, and they found this video of her dancing in college. And I mean, it was just circulating nonstop, and they were using that to be like, see, she's such a, you know, airhead, she's not serious. And it was just a video of like her having fun in college. And it was, you know, not inappropriate in the slightest, but even if it were, sort of who cares, but they just really went after her for that. And it was like, she can't simultaneously be like, you know, pretty and fun and then also be taken seriously in this position of power. Like those things were just incompatible for her Republican colleagues. And, but then for, you know, other young women, it's like really cool to see this, you know, young woman who's like, what, 30 or thereabouts, who have this sort of working class background and now is in Washington and is getting all this attention. Like it's really inspiring for other young women who might have political aspirations to see that.
Well, and what I love about it is she cares. She cares, and she's decided, you know what, I'm going to do something.
That's right.
That's what that's what our system is supposed to be about.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And then you have so many people retaining these positions of power who it's clear that they don't care in the slightest. And,
right.
You know, I'm from Kentucky, so I feel like, I mean, I have never cast a vote for Mitch McConnell, but as a Kentuckian, I feel some degree of responsibility for that. And it's just like, man, you have these people who just represent like an older vision of like American politics and, you know, just so clearly are focused on power and money and just don't care about people. And then you have people who from these non-traditional backgrounds, like AOC, who it's clear that they actually care and, you know, but they pay the price for it a little bit.
So now, I mean, feminism seems to me something that is misunderstood.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that with the assumption that I understand it. But one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about is, I mean, misogyny wouldn't continue to be, and I'm thinking about, you know, being an American and living in the United States, and it needs women who are part of the problem to sustain.
Oh yeah.
And, yeah. And it's, and I've, you know, somehow gotten to a point in my life where it, being a kid who grew up in central Indiana and, you know, people don't have conversations like this where I grew up, not really, you know, have educated myself enough to be able to see these things. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of, why do you think it is that so many women are part of this problem?
Yeah, I mean, I think like, at least in a lot of social contexts, like we are socialized to think in these ways. And, you know, like gender kind of starts working on us from, you know, day one, right? In my case, I had excellent parents and I had an older brother. So, you know, it was cool that I got into like Star Wars and wrestling and stuff like that. But in a lot of cases, right, you have, you know, this is for boys, this is for girls. And very early on, we start reproducing these things about gender. Mm-hmm. And I think that like we do tend to indoctrinate children with these ideas, for instance, that like, you know, we should all be in heterosexual relationships where women are sort of at home taking care of childcare and sort of housework and things like that. And men are out doing civic life and being in positions of authority. And I think that undoing that takes a lot of work, and it also takes opportunities for critical reflection maybe a lot of people don't have. And I know, like, even teaching undergraduate students, you know, I get a lot of students who have had belief systems, whether they're sort of Christian belief systems or more conservative belief systems, sort of passed down to them, and they've never had the opportunity to really like think about them critically or call them into question in any way, right? So they're kind of operating with what they've been given without thinking about it in any serious way.
Well,
so I think, yeah, you know, there are a lot of people invested in keeping that system going, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and this is one of the things that has come up for me a lot with this podcast, because, you know, this to me, I want it to be like a celebration of self. Mm-hmm. And if what we're doing is living to the tune of all this indoctrination, mm-hmm. whether it be related to work or gender or, you know, just living by this script that we're given.
Yeah.
Do we even know who we are?
Yeah, totally.
How do we even know who we are? Right?
Yeah. I think it's such a cool thing about what I do that I've had so many experiences, whether it's either like students that I've taught or if I've like given a, you know, like a more public talk, where I've had people come up to me after or email me after and be like, you know, I'd never thought about this thing critically before, but like now I see that, you know, either there was this assumption that I held or I've never really thought about this belief that I thought that I held or something like that. And giving people opportunities to actually do that sort of critical thinking is really important. And I think we need more of it, more of it sort of outside of the university, like public philosophy or philosophy for, you know, younger kids, just more opportunities for people to actually challenge their belief systems that they might not have any good reasons for having other than, you know, people told me that this was the way things were.
Well, and, you know, to me, what happens and, you know, I'm thinking about the Harry Styles thing where he was on the cover of Vogue magazine wearing a dress recently. You know, when we think we know how the world is supposed to be because that's what we're taught, when that gets threatened, we feel threatened. And, you know, there's fear and it's an existential fear that's like, maybe the world's not what I thought it was. I can't even let that into my consciousness. You know, it's like pushing away. And to me, like I had a conversation with my son about this, the Harry Styles thing. And if you're listening and you don't know about this, I mean, he wore a dress, he appeared on the cover of Vogue, and, you know, right-wing media went batshit crazy. You know, professing what men are supposed to be and what they're supposed to wear and what's the world coming to and all this stuff. And, you know, how just the idea that, you know, they're trying to destroy masculinity and make everyone be only one gender and all this crazy shit. Right.
Yeah.
And, but in reality, if you stop and look at what happened in the context of this indoctrination, for a man like that to wear a dress on the cover of a magazine takes extraordinary courage. And, you know, if men are supposed to be brave, what do you want? You know, I mean, what's more brave than that? To swim against the stream.
Exactly. Yeah.
And here you're bashing it, you know? And, and I think a lot of it is because we don't understand it, but you know, one of the things we don't have to understand it. We don't have to understand everything that other people do or what other people want to do or how they want to dress or who they want to love or, you know, I mean, it doesn't have to threaten who we are. And I think the only way it ever really does is if we don't know who we are in the first place. Right.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I tell my students sort of, cause I do a lot of stuff in my classes that I know will probably either be the first time they thought about something or been exposed to like a different way of life or a different way of loving or being in the world. And I always tell them like, look, you don't have to understand, and you won't in a first person direct way understand, but you have to be open and empathetic and at least respectful at the sort of very least, right? And I think you're right, like when different ways of life sort of threaten what people take to be given or taken to be sort of like the norm. I think about this, you know, I usually teach a unit on marriage equality, and you think about the panic leading up to the 2015 Supreme Court ruling in Obergefell that gave same-sex couples the right to marry in the U.S. The panic was around like the threat to quote-unquote traditional marriage. And it's just like, of course that didn't happen. Like the, you know, queer couples can get married and just as many heterosexual couples get married and, you know, same or opposite sex marriage wasn't threatened in any way. But just like any time that people sort of sense of what is normal or sense of what is traditional is sort of pushed back against, that there's that real discomfort with that. And that's part of like, you know, what I try to challenge with my students and sort of the public more generally. But I still get, go on.
No, it's just intolerance in disguise. That's what it is.
Yeah, I still sort of, despite my best efforts and the sorts of, you know, ideas I try to expose people to, I still sometimes get students, right, who are like, but if we let, you know, queer people get married, then we'll end reproduction, you know, just like all these things that are, you know, empirically absurd. But I you know, like
what, like people are going to stop having sex. Really?
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah. I certainly think that. And it's like, no, people had kids outside of marriage before queer couples could get married, and they will continue to do that.
Right.
We're going to be just fine. We're overpopulated anyway, but that's a separate issue. Right. But yeah, I still get students who are sort of like, well, you know, children need a strong father figure that embodies masculinity and a nurturing, soft sort of mother figure and things like that, where they're just not open to the fact that, you know, masculinity can take different forms and femininity can take different forms, and children can end up just fine sort of with, as long as they have loving, stable homes and parents. And we don't need to be so wedded of traditional gender and sort of traditional heterosexual marriage and things like that. And in fact, we'd be better off if we weren't so wedded to those things.
Well, and a lot of it, I think, is it's not rational. It's emotional.
Yeah, for sure.
Because, and I mean, you know, and Donald Trump is kind of the embodiment of all this, like, anger about this stuff, you know, about how things ought to be and what's the world coming to and all that. And we're not going to let this country turn into whatever they think it's going to turn into. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if I'm a male student in your class and my dad was a meathead and my mom was like, you know, soft, and, you know, my worldview was that that's how it's supposed to be. And mm-hmm. then if that's challenged, then that's going to scare the shit out of me. Right.
Yeah.
Like on some level.
Yeah.
But that, just because their dad was tough, that's not, you know, that doesn't mean he's a great dad. I mean, yeah, that just means he was tough, whatever, you know?
Yeah. And it certainly doesn't mean that that's the only way that, you know, parenting can be done well, right? Like, you might have had a dad who was more, you know, emotional and nurturing, and you could have ended up just fine. Or,
well, know, it's about love. That's the thing. Mm-hmm. That's the point, I think, that gets missed in all of this, is that love is supposed to be the point, right?
Yeah. I mean,
that's what kids need.
Totally.
And it probably doesn't even really matter what shape it comes in, as long as they have it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I've worked on some stuff in like adoption, and, you know, my doctoral supervisor is an adoptive parent, and just like all the research says, right? Kids are super resilient, and, you know, they can, even children that have been through a lot of traumatic stuff, they can usually bounce back and fare really well if they're in sort of loving, supportive, mm-hmm. stable, nurturing homes. And so this idea that like there's only one sort of family unit that's appropriate for raising kids, and it's the sort of heterosexual married one, is just not true. You know, but it's getting people to sort of think about that critically and get them to sort of question that is half of the battle, I suppose.
Well, and I think to get people to actually think for themselves and formulate an opinion that's not influenced by the status quo, mm-hmm. it's pretty difficult, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's okay. I was just going to say, like, I feel like social media just exacerbates that problem, right? Like, we're all in echo chambers to some extent, and we're used to only talking to people that have similar views to us and getting those views validated constantly. So, like, thinking outside of our status quo is, like, really freaking difficult. To actually, like, step back and try to be unbiased or try to evaluate an argument without just being, you know.
Well, and we don't even have a one status quo anymore.
Yeah.
You know, it's in terms of politically, we're really divided. And what scares me is so much of it just isn't based in reality.
Yeah.
You know? Like, being someone who's studied the Constitution a little bit and pays attention to politics and understands journalism. And, you know, I've been watching the right essentially try to take over the government. in the United States. That's what's been happening since the election. They've been trying to overturn, an election, which there's nothing out there that substantiates that in any way. You know, there's and so many Americans are just like, oh, whatever, not even really paying attention. And and in the midst of all this, I mean, Donald Trump, I mean, if you really paid attention, he did everything he possibly could to cheat to win, and he still lost. And he's fought and fought and fought and fought and fought until finally yesterday, it looks like, since the Electoral College voted, this is finally over now. But it's just insane to me that that's what's actually happening, and people aren't really tuned into it. Just kind of oblivious to it.
Yeah. Like how many times, like it's almost embarrassing. Like how many times do you have to lose to, you know, secede the election to the rightful winner? And the fact that so many other, you know, Republican leaders or, you know, politicians, maybe not leaders, maybe leadership's not the right word there, but people like Mitch McConnell who are only now, acknowledging.
Yeah. Today. Yeah.
Today. Yeah. And it's
On December 15th.
Yeah. Exactly. It's like, what is that going to do to just our sort of norms about democracy and, you know, how well we're able to sort of live up to democratic ideals and engage as, you know, a democratic society. It is really worrisome for me.
And I almost have to stop paying attention sometimes just because it bothers me so much. But one of the things that bothers me about all this, and I don't know what it's like in Canada, but and it's always bothered me as someone, you know, I grew up in a home where we talked about, you know, current events around the kitchen table. You know, we talked about politics and I work among a lot of people who are deeply spiritual, but they don't want to be involved in politics. They stray from the conversations. They compartmentalize it. It's too upsetting, you know, or, you know, that person who talks about it is kind of a little flaky or, you know, I mean, there's such a tendency to not even engage in public life at all. So many Americans don't vote too, you know, and that's always driven me crazy, but you know, it's really interesting to me. What do you feel like the ethical implications of that are? What do you believe about that?
Yeah, I just like you said, I really worry about the disengagement from public life and from politics, because I feel like at the point that we, you know, sort of either stop paying attention or we sort of think that the problems are sort of so bad that we can't fix them and we sort of give up, right? That allows the people in power to sort of win and to stay in power and to, you know, continue to do the sorts of things that, you know, people like me and probably people like you don't want to see happening in our politics. And so I worry about that kind of, you know, disengagement from public life. And I wish that we were better at exciting, like, you know, young people. I feel like the Democratic Party needs to do a lot of work and follow the leadership of people like Stacey Abrams, you know, thinking about how do we actually get people reinvested in politics and political life and to see, you know, how these decisions at every level impact our lives.
Well, and you know, the thing about Barack Obama, who I think is the type of figure that, you know, we need more people who have the energy and enthusiasm that he has, but not only that, he's grounded in principle.
Yeah.
And fun, you know, he's got personality. He's, you know, he's got all the parts. But his ascent happened so quickly that it's almost like we only had 8 years of him. And then, you know, then he's gone. I mean, he still influences things a little bit, but I wish we kind of had him for longer in a more substantive role, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's been such a big inspiration for me in terms of getting me like really invested and interested in politics, which, you know, to your previous question about people disengaging, I think we need more figures like that, that are relatable, who have actually like been through different life experiences, aren't the sort of textbook politician, are able to sort of have fun and laugh at themselves. And, you know, I remember when he was like running for the presidency the first time around, my brother and I and some other people we knew went to see him. He spoke at Nippert Stadium at the University of Cincinnati. And, you know, we lined up and people were just lined up for blocks trying to get in. And the way he could connect with people and just get people so excited, and then people paid attention. And, you know, I've been paying attention ever since, right? And so I think those sorts of figures who, you know, I think Bernie Sanders has done this in a lot of ways. And my personal political hero, Elizabeth Warren, I think she's done a good job of it. But, you know, like being a part of civic life is so important. And so many people have like really had to fight for women and Black people in America to have the right to vote. And so like not being engaged or not exercising that right, you know, I do think we have an ethical and social responsibility to do that. And I hope we get better at sort of, you know, getting that message out there and sort of showing people that it's relevant and important to their lives.
Well, and I think the kids are what really give me hope. You know, like what after what happened in Parkland. I mean, you know, I feel like there's a Wilco song that talks about every generation thinks it's the end of the world, you know? And it's always kids these days, and I'm sure it's been happening for millennia. But I think we're getting better. I really do. So, okay. So here's a little twist. So we've talked about, public life, right? And disengagement. Now you and I found you on a fan, in a group, a Jason Isbell group on Facebook, you know? And once in a while, I belong to the Wilco fan group. But once in a while, I'll see something somebody posts, and I'll just click and like, who is this person? You know, and that's how I found you. I think you posted a picture of you in a t-shirt and working from home or something.
Yeah,
and I was like, I have that t-shirt. And so, anyway, but Jason Isbell is a really good example of a musician, of an artist, of a celebrity who speaks his mind publicly. He uses his platform to stand up for what's right. At least that's how I see him.
Oh, absolutely.
And then you have, I mean, I'm sure you've seen on that board, people, you know, the shut up and sing crowd.
Yeah. Like, I mean, he has a line that says he won't do that. Come on.
right. He really does in the newest record. But you know, that whole thing where people just want to be entertained, and if you entertain, they don't want you to express an opinion. I mean, that just to me is, I don't get it, you know?
Yeah.
Because I feel like when you do have that kind of platform, it comes with a responsibility. That's the way I look at it.
Yeah, and I think I've been so pleased that so many of my favorite musicians and songwriters have been, you know, taking strong stances, whether it's in support of Black Lives Matter or, you know, all of the sort of fundraising efforts leading up to the election and right now for the Georgia runoffs. Like, you know, Death Cab did a Georgia EP to raise money for the Georgia Senate elections.
Yeah.
And the Mill Carton Kids released a live album raising money for that as well.
Is that the Ohio, Columbus, Ohio?
No, they released one from Georgia for the Georgia Senate runoffs.
Was that the Bandcamp release that they did? Okay. Because I ordered the record from the Columbus, Ohio.
Right.
That's coming out in the middle of January.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love them. Have you seen them live?
I have. A couple of times. Like, yeah, they're so good. I don't know if you've ever been to Newport Folk Fest, but.
No, man, I'd love to. One of these days I have to go to that. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But one of my favorite memories of them is they just came and did a sort of surprise pop-up impromptu sort of set in the beer garden at Newport. And it was just really intimate and fun. And, you know, weird things like that happen at Newport. You know, you're standing mm-hmm. there and you see Jason and Amanda playing with Mercy over in the family tent, or you see the tallest man on earth walking around and you're just like, this is a weird, happy place.
Yeah. So if you don't know about the Mill Carton Kids, especially if you like folky acoustic music, if you like harmonies, go to YouTube.
Do it right now.
Yeah, find them live. Because they're as entertaining, I think, on stage as anyone I've ever seen.
They're hilarious.
Yeah, the banter between them. I don't know how much of it's scripted. It's so good and so funny. Half the time I'm thinking they must have written this, you know, but they're great. They just have this chemistry between the two of them. And you even see it on their Instagram lives when they do stuff. They poke fun at each other and it's just, I don't know. I miss live music. I do. Yeah.
And do you remember what the last show you saw was before?
It was Jason Isbell in January in Fort Lauderdale area. It was a weird show. It was a new venue that's like a civic center. It was almost like a cross between a city hall and an auditorium, and the seats like rolled out. They were like the high school gym bleachers.
Right.
And he was playing If We Were Vampires, and in the middle of the song the lights went out in the whole place.
Oh, cool. I think I saw someone in the Isbell group post about this.
Yeah, and he was like, anybody know what's going on here? And you know, like, and finally after a couple minutes he said, you know what, we're just gonna go on back. We'll come back out when you guys get this figured out, you know.
Yeah.
And it only took a couple minutes, but he came back out and started the song over. But he's another one. If you don't know about Jason Isbell, I mean, especially if you like lyrics, I mean, I just think he's the most brilliant lyricist.
Mm-hmm.
He's a poet. He's really a poet. And, you know, I mean, if you ask him, he sees himself more as a guitarist. First, that's what I've heard him say, but yeah, just such a great songwriter, great musician. Can't beat his shows, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. And he's just, I mean, he really, you know, he pulls other people up, other artists, and, you know, he has a real interest in, you know, helping other people succeed. And honestly, one of my favorite artists right now and one of my favorite songwriters, Rustin Kelly. The first time I saw him was he was opening for Isbell at the Palace Theater in Louisville. And I was just, I mean, blown away by his songwriting. And, but yeah, I think Jason Isbell is somebody who, in addition to just being an incredible songwriter and musician, is somebody who has the sort of politics that we need and uses his platform incredibly well.
Well, and you know, if you follow him on Twitter,
yeah.
I mean, I don't think there's anybody better I'm really impressed by certain people who are just what I call good at the internet, you know? I mean, like, because, I mean, his comebacks are just incredible. And he's really, really funny. And, you know, he's like AOC. Like, she seemingly, like, can do no wrong on Twitter, you know? Right. I mean, the stuff that she says. You know, the whole drink water and don't be a racist.
Yeah.
I love that.
She's selling
hydrate and don't be a racist. her beauty tips. Yeah. That's, he's hilarious. I mean, I could go on and on about him, but
for sure.
So I bet you're writing a book, aren't you?
I am. Well, right now I've got one sort of probably we've written probably somewhere in the like 75 to 80% of it, but with one of my colleagues who I work with a lot. And so we're chugging along at that among other things. But
so you care to elaborate on that? What's it about?
Sure. The book that I'm writing with her is called Microaggressions in Medicine. And there we take a deep dive into the sort of way that language shapes physician-patient interactions. So we talk about the way that the speech phenomenon of microaggressions can shape communication and trust between patients from marginalized groups and their doctors, and then ultimately sort of health outcomes and so on. So we're really focused on that physician-patient interaction and the way that language shapes that.
So to someone who doesn't necessarily understand what a microaggression is, how would you describe that?
Yeah, so a microaggression is a sort of quick, often unthinking remark that somebody makes that, while maybe sort of seeming to them benign or sort of unintended, it can signal an underlying hostility toward or bias against a member of a marginalized group. So sort of an example would be misgendering a trans person or dead naming a trans person, which from the perspective of the person doing it, you know, might be an accident or might not be a big deal. But from the perspective of the person who's on the receiving end of it, who likely experiences it all the time, it can be deeply harmful, and especially in situations where they're already feeling vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And especially since it sort of happens over and over. So microaggressions are these sort of brief, commonplace linguistic actions that can signal that sort of hostility or sort of bias in often in unintended ways.
So that's the book you're working on now, and you have another one in the works?
Yeah, I'm working on another one that is an anthology of LGBTQ plus history and figures. And that's for a more, so the first the book I just mentioned is more oriented towards like an academic or an audience of sort of healthcare providers or medical students. The second book is for a trade press, so it's, you know, more oriented towards a more popular audience. So two very different sort of styles of writing. Lots of sort of jargon and statistics in the first, and sort of a more fun and lighter sort of presentation of queer figures and events throughout history in the second.
It sounds exciting. Sounds like you got a lot of good stuff going on. Any other big plans?
No plans right now other than, you know, finish out this dissertation, become, Dr. Stewart. Hopefully at some point, you know, the virus, clears up and I can make my way down south, cause I'm missing the US and the family in the US that I haven't seen since, you know, March. And that's about it.
Okay. Well, so can you talk a little bit about what made you decide to do this kind of work?
Yeah. It's pretty interesting because, you know, I was, I never thought it, if you would have asked me when I was, you know, 5, 10 or 15 years old, what I would be when I grew up, if I made a list, philosopher would not be on it. I was the first person in my family to attend college or university. And I didn't really have a sense of all of the sort of like options that were available to you. I had a pretty narrow sense of like what you could go into if you got to go to university. And so I thought I would become a physician. I entered as a pre-med biology major. I ended up falling in love with philosophy in a weird way, right? When I went to university, I didn't know what philosophy was. I needed a gen ed requirement. I saw on the course catalog, philosophy of literature and film. I love both literature and film. So I was like, I'll take that class. And then as these things go, I sort of found my footing and found my passion and, you know, redirected my course away from medical school and towards the pursuit of philosophy as sort of a full-time thing, with many ups and downs along the ways, but I'll spare you the sort of extended version. But yeah, I fell in love with philosophy. And after I did, I sort of couldn't look back.
So is there a philosopher who kind of lured you in?
My favorite philosopher is a philosopher by the name of Iris Marion Young. She's actually deceased now, but an incredible feminist philosopher. She has a book called Responsibility for Justice that's just been, you know, utterly changing for me and sort of my path. And I also, this is unpopular opinion among many feminists, but I love Aristotle. There's some controversial things in Aristotle's work, but I think virtue theory is right with respect to ethics. So I try to live my life in accordance with virtue ethics. So I also, Aristotelian ethics also brought me in.
So when was a time in your life when you feel like the younger version of you needed, you know, maybe some advice or support, or when would that have been? And what would you have said to her?
Yeah. When I think back, it was probably the most difficult and ultimately transformative, but I couldn't see that at the time. Points for me, it was, I was first away, doing my master's at the University of Colorado at Boulder. And I had just moved, you know, totally across the country from Kentucky, away from my support networks. And when I got there, I was experiencing a lot of imposter syndrome, a lot of doubt that I was cut out for this. The discipline of philosophy is overwhelmingly male dominated. And I was experiencing some of that misogyny we talked about earlier, some sort of offhand remarks. And I was just hating my experience. And I really thought it wasn't for me. So I was, you know, ready to sort of drop out and give up. And I was failing to sort of ask for help or ask for guidance or, you know, make use of the many resources that could have been available to me. And I was really just trying to internalize it and deal with it on my own. And that certainly didn't help things. And I think I spent a lot of time just utterly suffering. And, you know, once I went to my supervisor there and was like, I want to leave. I want to drop out, that kind of thing. And it was only then that she sort of helped me find resources and helped me find a community. And, you know, I was like, man, I should have done this before. And so I think that really taught me, right, that when we're going through these really tough things, even if we feel alone, we don't have to be alone, but sometimes it takes a lot of courage to sort of ask for help. And especially if you're the sort of person that's better at giving help than receiving it. So if I could look back and talk to me then, I would be like, you know, there are resources for you, there's a community for you, but you have to be sort of willing and brave enough to sort of ask for help. And I think that's something now that I try to keep in mind when I'm feeling moments of despair is really knowing that I don't have to face things like that alone.
Well, and you know, we're designed to be connected. Mm-hmm. And whoever that supervisor is who you went to and talked to, I bet you anything you feel extraordinarily close to her in one way or another.
Yes. And endlessly grateful to her, because I made it through what I thought was sort of the end of my graduate training. And now I'm in a place where I feel like I'm right where I need to be. And I almost gave up and I almost sort of let go of my dreams in that moment. Mm-hmm. So I'm endlessly sort of indebted to her for, you know, drying my tears and sort of helping me find a way to get through that.
Yeah. But you know, that vulnerability, when we take that to someone, almost invariably it's met with love and support. And it just, it's where closeness comes from. It's where intimacy comes from. And I think if we thought about that more, I mean, I've been through plenty of times in my life when I didn't want to talk about what was really bothering me. I mean, there's almost always something that I'm got going on that I don't want to talk to other people about. If I'm going to be really honest about it, there's almost always something.
Relatable. Yeah.
Yeah. And, but always, you know, I've learned that lesson time and time again in my life. When I'm really honest about what's going on with me with someone, I'm always glad I was, because it's always, I think we fear that we're going to be rejected.
Yeah.
And it's the opposite that happens. No matter how bad it is, we think whatever we did or whatever, you know, it always seems to have the opposite effect. So.
Yeah. That vulnerability always ends up being worth it, even when it's really hard.
Yeah. And, you know, those people that, like you're talking about, that supervisor, those people in my world who were there for me, I mean, they can be someone who I haven't spoken to in 20 years, but I love them every bit as much as someone who I'd seen every day for all those years, you know?
Yeah, so, for sure.
Anyway, well, this has been great. I appreciate you taking the time to do this. I hope you've enjoyed it.
I haven't. So much.
Well, we went in all different directions. and it's fun, but you know, so I guess just to kind of button it up, you know, this being a show for, I want this to be a show for people to kind of, people who kind of need that little nudge to trust themselves and be themselves and live that out. And where do you think philosophy can fit into that picture? Or is there something that you would suggest that someone read, or you have anything to offer in that vein?
Yeah. And I think you're right. And I think, like, for me, coming to terms with sort of who I am in a lot of different ways, right? I'm a queer identified person, just a number of features of myself. I've really found sort of solidarity in reading the writings of others and things like that. There are just some things I would recommend for people if you're interested in philosophy and sort of getting a sort of intro take on, you know, some different areas of philosophy. There's a great podcast called The Unmute Podcast with Maisha Cherry. Maisha is a Black feminist philosopher. She's fantastic, and she interviews young, diverse philosophers about what they're working on, and you can get, it's very conversational, very sort of oriented, you know, toward non-specialist audience. So you can learn a lot about philosophy in a sort of short podcast. So I think that's really good. There's a book I would recommend to people, Kate Mann's Down Girl, that it's on issues of misogyny. And I think it helps sort of shine a light on issues of gender sort of politics in our social life. So I think those things are really great, but if anybody's like interested in philosophy and they sort of want me to point them in directions, I believe you have my contact information, and I'm happy for people to sort of reach out and if they have things they want to pursue, I would love to give them resources or point them.
Yeah, your Instagram handle is Ohio is for haters with a Z. I noticed that. I, being a guy from Indiana, I appreciated that. Ohio is for haters. Yes, I'll include links in the show notes to all your places. But now Kate Mann, I think I reached out to her trying to get her on this podcast at one point.
You and everybody
else. Yeah. I don't think I got a response. Yeah.
Easier to book than Kate Mann, it turns out. Well deserved, getting a lot of attention for her very brilliant work on misogyny and gender. And I strongly encourage, where you can, to sort of read the things that she does for a popular audience. And she has a new book out that I have on my desk that I haven't been able to fully dive into yet, but it's called Entitled, and sort of the sister book to Down Girl. So I'm looking forward to that one as well. But
awesome. Well, I'm looking forward to when you publish your books. And I hope that when you do, you'll come back and talk about the publication.
Happily, I would love to.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate this. And have a happy holiday season.
Yeah, thanks so much. And same to you.
Thanks. right, there you go, Heather Stewart. Thank you to Heather for coming on the show. You can hear the podcast on Amazon, Apple Podcasts, Breaker, Google Podcasts, Listen Notes, Overcast, Pandora, Podbay, Podcast Addict, Podchaser, Radio Public, Spotify, Stitcher, and more. Please subscribe, like, follow, whatever. Every little bit helps. If you enjoy listening to the show, please take the time to leave a review, a rating, or both, especially on Apple Podcasts, or if you're not an Apple device person, on Podchaser, or wherever you listen. Links in the show notes to both of those. If you have questions or comments, you can call 561-247-4757. And leave a message on the show's voicemail. If you do, you're implying consent to use that audio on the podcast. Looking forward to doing that someday. So love to hear from you and value any feedback you might offer. For early access to the newest episode, as well as unedited interviews, you can support the show on Patreon. Patreon.com/thepathtoauthenticity. Just a reminder to you guys, to commemorate the 100th episode of the podcast, Heather Sundquist Hall created an original work of art available for purchase. Again, link in the show notes, proceeds. Just a reminder, you can purchase the episode 100 artwork created by the artist Heather Sundquist Hall. It's available in two different sizes. A portion of the proceeds benefits iSpeak Media. Link in show notes or visit goldenhourprints.com. I want to thank the band Punk Rock Opera, whose music you hear throughout the show. Their songs are used with permission from the artist and under a Creative Commons license. I want to thank our sponsors, The Manor, Windrose Recovery. Thank you to Wendy Chen at Equivox. Please visit thepathtoauthenticity.com. You can email the show at thepathtoauthenticity@gmail.com. On the website, you can join our community mailing list. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, find the Sunday playlist on Spotify. Thanks again to Heather Stewart. Got plenty more good stuff to come. Looking forward to the next episode a lot with a guy who I really, really love and has played an important role in my life over the last 3 decades. Anyway, hope you guys are having a happy new year so far. Thank you so much for listening to the show. Hope you come back. If you like it, share it with somebody. Can use all the support I can get here. I appreciate it. Be nice.
I fear this change. a guitar player.
The Path to Authenticity is powered by Equivox. For digital marketing and web design services, visit equivox.com.